Hi, I'm Ryan Dodge Cook, and this is Summit to Talk About, your one-stop podcast for all things hiking, hills, wild camping, and the great outdoors. It's fantastic to be back with a brand new and very exciting series. Until now, Summit to Talk About has been an audio-only podcast, but this summer we've stepped it up and met most of our guests face-to-face so that we can bring you video content too. So if you want to see where we've been and who we've been hanging out with, head over to the Summit to Talk About YouTube channel and please help us grow by liking and subscribing. I'm very grateful to say that the podcast continues to be supported by Hiker. Hiker is the best app for all your navigation and planning when hitting the trails. In January 2023, Hiker announced that offline maps are now free for everyone. Other awesome features include custom waymarkers for when you're plotting your own routes and the live tracker so you can share your location. Choose from a variety of different map layers to suit your needs and location wherever that might be in the world. If you choose to upgrade to Hiker Pro, you'll unlock all the cool features, and if you use the link in the show notes, you'll get an awesome 20% off. For Series 5, we've also teamed up with Zolio. Zolio offer peace of mind in the great outdoors with their satellite communication device. The device is easy to use with the app, as it's just like using your usual text messaging function from a mobile device. Except, when you have no phone signal, Zolio connects via the Iridium satellite network, so you stay connected everywhere. The device is compact, hooks anywhere using the carabiner clip, looks awesome, and the battery lasts for ages. Zolio's features include global two-way text, email and app-to-app messaging, SOS alerting with 24/7 monitoring with Global Rescue, 24/7 medical assist access for non-emergency medical help, and one-touch button to check in with others to let them know you're okay. It has weather updates and location sharing. All of this for much lower price than competitors. And as a Summit to Talk About listener, you get free device activation with the code RyanXZolio. But don't miss out, as this is limited to just 53 activations. You can also check out my video on YouTube with my initial thoughts on the device and see the link in the show notes for more information on Zolio. In this episode, we met with Alex Staniforth. Alex is a really inspiring character with a passion for the outdoors and fundraising for charities. He had a dream of climbing Mount Everest from a young age and put his all into making it happen at just 17 years old. Unfortunately, in 2014, as Alex was at base camp, a huge avalanche swept down the mountain, tragically killing 16 people. This put a halt on the expedition and Alex returned the following year, only to come face to face with an avalanche en route to Camp 1, after an earthquake hit Nepal. Alex has since gone on to write two books about his experiences, and is now a motivational speaker, as well as the founder of the charity Mind Over Mountains. Alex shares his story of overcoming adversity and taking on big challenges. I hope you enjoy. So today I am joined by Alex Staniforth. We're up here in his own house in Kendal, just outside the Lake District. First of all, thank you very much for inviting us and for giving us your time, because this is obviously new to get out and start seeing people. And so we really appreciate you giving up your time and allowing us to come into your home. So welcome onto our podcast, first of all.
It's great to be here, you know, and I can talk about adventure all day, every day. So it's a pleasure. And thank you for having me on. I hope something I say and share today will be helpful for people as well.
Yeah, I think so. And from what I've read about you and from following you on social media as well, I think that your life, albeit short so far, has been full of adventure. And we're still, early days, aren't we, I'd say, for yourself.
I hope so. I hope that the best is yet to come. People often say to me, I've done so much in such a short time and what's next? And I guess my challenge is sustaining that, because keeping that pace and sometimes life has to slow down. But I really hope that this is just the start. The challenge is trying to maintain that.
Yeah, I think it's important actually, because even just what you've just mentioned there is people asking you what's next. Do you sometimes feel that as pressure? Do you feel like you have to keep providing people with the content, i.e. I've got to get another adventure in because people are asking for it?
You have to keep on providing the goods, the entertainment. Inevitably, there is a pressure, but I think it's more of an internal pressure, you know, and I find that after a period of time, might be a year or 2 years, there's kind of an itch that I can't quite get rid of. And there's generally something missing in life. I just feel it. It's that intuition that I need something big and exciting just to change the pace a bit.
Yeah.
Just to create some new energy and new stories and new content and just new life lessons.
Yeah.
And often the answer to that is planning a big adventure. You know, for example, I've not done anything big now for about, big in my terms for about 3 years. And there's definitely a void there. So I've done lots of little mini adventures and endurance stuff in the meantime, but it's not quite hitting the spot. But inevitably, it's like you get known for something, you know, and it's like, you know, certain celebrities and musicians, they get known for one line or one song and they get asked to play it every time they go somewhere. And it's just like, if you're going to get known for something, then you've got to own it. You know, you've got to enjoy it. And I do find, and it's maybe true or just a perception, that I kind of not adding any value unless I'm doing these things. But you've got to be in the right mindset. You've got to be in the right place in life. You've got to have the right circumstances to be able to commit yourself to an adventure. And afterwards, it's really important having that downtime just to reflect and just to enjoy not having to do anything for a while. So it's a pressure, but it's mostly internal. And people mean well. People genuinely enjoy following this stuff. And so when I don't have something, I kind of feel like I'm just a bit the fly on the wall, really.
Yeah, yeah. So let's go back then, because I've already mentioned that you're quite young. In the grand scheme of things, we've got a long way to go. Where did it all begin for you? Because it's always important for me to find out how do people, particularly people like you, have, in my eyes, have been very, very successful in the outdoors industry and the world of the outdoors and adventure. How did that start for you?
Interesting. It's interesting because, like, we all perceive ourselves differently, and I don't see myself kind of successful in any way yet. There's so much more I need to do. But I guess from where I started to how I've got to here, at least, I can say, it all started really when I was about... I think so. I was brought up in Chester. I wasn't born in the lakes. I've been here for about 4 years now. And I was never your typical adventurer. It wasn't like something that was instilled in me. You know, my family spent a lot of time in the caravan in Wales and you know, a lot of traveling. And I lived near a forest. So from a young age, I was always connected with nature, but not to the kind of the same extremes that I use it now. Now it's a way to challenge myself. Before, it was just kind of something I did. But I had a few challenges through school, like we all did. But for me, it was mostly having epilepsy when I was 9.
Okay.
It was a really kind of unsettling thing. That was soon brought under control, but it was just a catalyst for a whole host of different things to deal with at such a young age. So I've had a stammer all my life, which I've never really known life without that. Badly bullied through school, which kind of didn't help with confidence, and anxiety and panic attacks, you know, triggered by the epilepsy and I guess a general health anxiety. So I guess I remember even when I was fairly young, you know, having a seizure in McDonald's for many years, just the smell of fast food could then trigger a panic attack.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I felt constantly under threat. You know, the world was a really threatening place and I thought that I was a victim. You know, I thought that I was never really good enough. I was looking for that thing, that belonging, that purpose, and never really found it. Until I was about 14. And my friend Tom and his family invited me on a hill walking weekend in the lakes. Something they did as a family, something I'd never really done. And I said yes, I went on that weekend. And I remember even going for like a meal out, I was a nervous wreck. I thought I was going to have a panic attack.
Yeah.
Yet we'd been in the hills that day and it'd been the exact opposite. Because I remember us walking near Blencathra on Sutafell. And in the mountains for the first time, just blew my mind. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it before. I'd been brought up in a lovely part of the world, you know, quite rural, but this was like a whole new level. And just became captivated by the idea of climbing big mountains. And at some point that day, the idea of climbing Everest popped into my mind. Triggered this kind of curiosity. And at 14, you think you can take on the world.
Yeah.
So I went home, I started researching it. And I remember just this connection with the Lake District started. And I've had that ever since. That's why I moved here.
Yeah.
And after reading about Everest and reading like mere mortals had climbed it, it was like, that's who I want to be. I have to be that person. That was a way of overcoming the bullying, the self-doubt, and proving myself and proving the bullies wrong, really.
Yeah.
I kind of decided at 14 I was going to stand on top of the world. And so with that in mind, that was what triggered this kind of passion for the outdoors. And then it was a case of finding other challenges. You know, what else could I do? So I'd done hill walking, and then it was mountain biking and rock climbing and scuba diving and paragliding and just this whole range of stuff. I think that's when I really found my path in life. And then there's a few other things happen in the same sort of time. So I was an only child, you know, so my parents weren't particularly outdoorsy. My dad was a marathon runner. And we went on holiday to France with my dad and my stepmum. And my stepmum put a 2-year-old bet that I couldn't run a mile with my dad. Now, I should say that I was really unfit at school. I despised exercise. I mean, I was the kid that came last in cross country in year 7. But I wanted that 2 euros. You know, it's a lot of money when you're 13.
Yeah.
And I dragged myself around, and it was those things that just gave me that sense of achievement, you know, and I realized that I wanted the next fix. And so it was just a few mindset shifts, really.
Wow. So how much could you have earned if you'd have run 26 miles?
I don't
what
know.
What a great holiday that would have been.
It would have been, yeah, but the irony is now, as I beat my dad's marathon PB, so that's what matters. But he did beat me part run a few weeks ago, so, you know, it all comes around.
So the challenge continues. Yeah.
Yeah, I think my PBs are safe for a while.
Yeah.
But my dad was my inspiration, you know, and he got me into running and has supported me ever since.
Yeah. That was going to be one of my questions for you, like, who is your inspiration for the outdoors world? And is it still your dad now?
Dad's definitely one of them. Dad got me into running, you know, and he'd done the Three Peaks, which became my first kind of big challenge that I ever did when I was 16. And there's been a lot of them have been related to Everest. So when I had this Everest goal, the first step really was reaching out to other young Everest climbers and role models. And essentially, how could I follow in their footsteps? Mm. And to be fair, there's not many young Everest climbers at the time. There was literally about 3 or 4 kind of English ones who had a very similar background to me. What was great was that they were just like me. What stood them out was their commitment, that Everest had become their full-time job because it had to be. And they were the proof that I could do this, that I could achieve the same thing if I was willing to follow the same process. So coming across them was massively, that's what changed everything, because suddenly it started to feel possible.
Yeah.
Tim, who became my Everest guide both years, was a big inspiration as well, because naturally he was that window to achieving this thing. And there's many, many others at different stages of life, but I think another one, I think was Bear Grylls, which I know he's a big name and it sounds like a fangirl thing. But when I was injured, and so when I was about 16, I suddenly got injured. I couldn't run, I couldn't climb or cycle for like the best part of a year. And all of a sudden, having discovered this outdoor thing, it was then taken away from me. And I couldn't cope with that. I thought, you know, I was safe. I was clear of all the bad stuff now. And in that time, you know, not being able to pursue this goal and losing that coping mechanism and all the depression and eating disorder and everything that came along with that, a good friend of mine, Rich, gave me the book by Bear Grylls, Mud, Sweat and Tears.
Yeah.
And it was just reading that story of how he broke his back in a parachuting accident, and then climbed Everest 18 months later at 23, having had to learn to walk again.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, if he can overcome that, then I can overcome this. And that was the inspiration to actually change this kind of dream into a goal by setting the date.
Yeah.
And it all kind of came together, and I was like, I can't stay here. I can't just wait. And I remember an orthopedic consultant at the time telling me, like, you might just not ever be able to run properly again. It might just be that you've got something wrong with you and you can't run properly.
Yeah. And I bet that stuck with you more than any of the positive things that was to come with it.
At the time, it absolutely floored me. But at the same time, it was kind of like a flashback to all the bullying. And it's a bit like, right then, I'll show you. You know?
Yeah. Oh, right.
Not in a negative way. He was just doing his job and I respect that. But I've had a similar thing recently, you know, happen again when I had like a, you know, when I had a cardiologist kind of saying to me, you know, you might never get back to where you were again. And it's like, I can't wait. I've got to find out, you know. And what Bear inspired me to do was to set the date. So basically I said, right, 2014, I want to climb Everest. At this point, I didn't know whether I was going to run or train properly again. I was 17. I had 18 months to try and raise about 40 grand to fund the trip and to finish my A-levels, you know. So it probably doesn't make much sense, but I just knew that's what I had to do.
Yeah. And how was that? So you've gone from 14-year-old boy who's gone for a walk in the Lake District and thinking, I really fancy going to Everest, to getting to Everest. How did that period in between, so how did the training come about at such a young age with your A-levels and things like that? How did you manage all of that?
So I guess it was a very busy 4 years. I had a crammed lot into that, and I guess that was part of the reason for setting this kind of deadline, where some people say, why not wait to, you know, put a lifetime of mountaineering behind you? And that obviously is the most common sense thing. You know, people say, what's the rush? You know, why don't you just wait? And generally, most people will approach Everest after decades and decades of experience. I'm not undermining that at all. I just was in a position that I was able to do a lot. I didn't have, you know, a full-time job. I was still a student. And I was willing to take anything steps I needed, you know. And I went rock climbing for the first time with Tim Mosedale, who would become my guide both years. I mean, he climbed Everest 6 times, so I was in very good hands.
Yeah.
I liked his ethos, very safe, very pragmatic, and very focused on being an independent mountaineer. You know, Tim always said, it doesn't matter how good your support team is in the death zone, you know, you're the only one who can put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
And so he essentially held up the hoops, and I had to jump through them. So first step was climbing the Alps. It was Mont Blanc when I was 17. Going to Nepal for a month to try and climb a 6,000 meter and a 7,000 meter peak called Burunsi a year later.
Right.
And obviously all the fitness training in between, but you realize that the fitness doesn't really do much for you. It's about time altitude, getting to know your body and how it responds.
Yeah.
So that was what I did. And would I have done more in hindsight? Yes, but I don't feel like I was making myself a liability. I felt that I had enough to take care of myself and the right team around me. You know, on Everest, you can cut corners and they're the people that get killed.
That's it, yeah.
Because they don't have the support, the Sherpas, the oxygen, and that kind of guiding leadership. So it was just a very, very busy 4 years, you know. And after I finished my A-levels, and I pretty much whilst I was doing my A-levels, trying to raise the money for corporate sponsorship was a full-time job. You know, day in and day out, to the early hours of the morning, sending emails to thousands of companies, trying to get them to believe in this kid with a dream, you know. And I think because of that, because I was just like a normal kid, you know, I didn't have parents just to sign me a check. I was washing pots in my local pub at weekends. That wasn't going to pay for it. A lot of people really want to get behind the underdog, you know, and they see this kid with this massive dream and they wanted to help that become a reality. And fortunately, I got the support I needed. But there was never any guarantee of success. You know, this all could have been for nothing. I could have spent a year and a half and then I could have missed out. But you just have to trust the process. And somehow it comes together in just the last minute, which 4 weeks before was when I got that final big chunk of sponsorship.
Wow.
So I'm very grateful to them for making that happen.
Yeah.
But that was it, 4 years. And to be honest, when I was there, it kind of felt, it's like, wow, I'm really here. What? It just felt surreal.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, even just seeing the Himalayas is breathtaking enough. And then to think that you're stood at the foot of Everest and you are about to go up beyond base camp, which is, you know, a lot of people go to base camp, but you're going beyond and you're going into the Khumbu Icefall, et cetera, et cetera. So let's talk about your first Everest expedition, 2014.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go into that because there's obviously, I say first expedition, and we'll come on to the second one in a second, but let's talk about the first one.
Well, it's funny you mentioned around going into the Icefall because that year we didn't even leave base camp. So a day before we got there, there was a big massive avalanche in the Icefall. Big Serac came off and sadly killed 16 Sherpas below. You know, they were in the worst possible place at the worst possible time and the biggest disaster in Everest history at the time. So with that in mind, things went pretty nasty pretty quickly. There was a lot of politics and strikes and threats and things, and it just was a really sad situation. So we had to pack up and go home. You know, we didn't even get to start climbing because it just wouldn't have been appropriate to do so.
Yeah.
So we went back, and obviously you're back home thinking, right, okay, that wasn't meant to happen. What do we do now? You know, you think that the harder you work, the luckier you'll get. And I guess at 18, I was naive to think, oh, you know, I've done all the hard work now.
Yeah.
Then you get a real poignant lesson of the mountains that they don't give a damn how much you've spent or how hard you've worked. that is the point of adventure.
Yeah.
So you just have to, you know, there's no point blaming anybody. There's no point whinging about it. You've just got to find the opportunity. So I had another year to go home to train harder, to come back stronger, and took another year out doing, you know, more training, more endurance stuff, because you realize really it's probably 90% mental, only 10% physical.
Yeah.
And went back 2015 for a second attempt, you know, having got the money together again. And in hindsight, probably came back in a lot better state of mind and body than I was the first time, which is good.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously 2015, you know, you think, well, surely can't happen twice. But yeah, we were heading up to Camp One for the first time. We left base camp in the early hours of the 25th of April. And we were just below Camp One when the earthquake hit Nepal. So yeah, all I can remember really is just this sound of ice breaking off the mountain. And then behind that, you've got this distant avalanche coming straight for us. And yeah, I mean, for the first time in my life at 19, thinking that's it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's nothing you can do but stand and take it.
And so where you were then, just below Camp One, what sort of devastation was there at that particular point? Did you have to take cover? Was you sort of unscathed, or...?
There was nowhere to take cover because we were in the Western Coombe, which is this massive valley. It's called the Valley of Silence for that reason.
Yeah.
You know, you're surrounded by like 7,000 meter peaks on both sides. Where I was just out of the more technical part. So it's like basically just big blocks of ice, and not kind of so much the kind of, you know, all the crevasses that I'd passed before, but just in this big open valley and half an hour away from probably Camp One. So it was quite flat at this point. So you're very exposed. There's no cover. Whereas further down, you know, you're kind of winding your way through big blocks and house sized blocks of ice and ladders and everything. It's quite a cool place to be. I'm glad I wasn't there when the avalanche hit, because being on a ladder above like a crevasse hundreds of meters deep, it wouldn't have been the place to be. But initially, you know, because the fog was so thick, you kind of hear this noise and you assume there's something happening, but you're not quite sure what. I remember this kind of strange kind of calm, you know, after a while, assuming that it had fallen behind me, you know. But initially, I just set off as fast as I could. It was like panic set in, right, I've got to get out of here quick. And as I said, there was this strange kind of calm came over me after a while, because I kind of assumed it must have fallen behind me because it should have hit me by now. And then all of a sudden this big cloud of white just hit me from all sides, and it was just like being shot in the face by a big snow cannon, you know.
Yeah.
This deafening blast of wind, this white everywhere, just knocking me off my feet. And in those things, you can only assume the worst. You know, you think of what happened the year before, you put two and two together and think, oh no, you know, it's me. And that kind of sickening fear, like properly in the pit of your stomach. And that, it could have been seconds or milliseconds, but it's just that realization that any second now, it's just going to go black.
Wow.
And it all happens in this, that kind of microcosm of time. And that genuine, genuine fear of like, oh, right, this is it.
Yeah.
Because you just feel this white around you. And then I guess time kind of, you know, freezes. You know, you don't know how long it really is. But all I remember then is that you're the snow dropping to the ground. And it's kind of this, you know, everything just goes silent again.
Yeah.
I open my eyes again. I mean, I kind of got back up. And we'd just been hit by this big blast of powder. So the debris, the ice that you think is going to bury you, never came. So basically, we'd just been kind of caught the edge of it. So all the wind had displaced the snow, and it was just, there was nothing really solid there. But again, you assume the worst. You go into survival mode.
Yeah.
And straight away, I got on the radio, no response. So I think, right, because at this point, Tim and a teammate were about 10-15 minutes behind me. I was completely on my own at the point, because I'd been so slow that day. I'd been right at the back of the team. Most of the team were already at Camp One by this point when it hit, so they were further up the valley. I couldn't see them. I said I couldn't see more than 300 meters away. So I just straight away assumed that, you know, Tim was gone. no response on the radios at all. It's like, is Camp One going to be there?
Yeah.
But you just have to get yourself to safety. Got to Camp One eventually, and actually there was a few tents which had just been flattened. But luckily, all the others emerged and everybody was unhurt, yeah. Which was like a relief. Everybody at Camp One was pretty much unharmed.
Yeah.
But we're now trapped at sort of 6,000 metres for 2 days, not knowing how long we're going to be there. Not knowing as well that actually we've been in the safest place of all. You know, base camp had just been...
It was devastated, wasn't it? Yeah.
Like a plane crash. Mm. It's gone.
And so the Cumberwa Icefall at this point was behind you.
Pretty much, yeah.
And you were heading up. So was you going to head up anyway, regardless? So this happened. This avalanche had nearly taken you out completely. And then did you at that point think, should I go back down or should I carry on to Camp One?
At that point, I was so close to Camp One. I had to get to Camp One.
Yeah.
And all the support and the supplies were there. That was the only safe place you could be in this situation. As it happens, the route down had been kind of pulled out anyway. So I didn't really have... I didn't know at the time there wasn't an option to do that. And obviously it wasn't unsafe, because it wasn't safe because you got aftershocks and all of this. So there was no hesitation. I had to get to Camp One. And we did think about going to Camp Two purely because there's more supplies there. That was the only reason for going up the mountain. But any thought about carrying on at this point was obviously gone, as you'd expect.
Yeah.
You know, so that was, that was that.
And so you headed back. So you were up at Camp One for 2 days.
2 days before we got flown down by helicopter.
Yeah.
At first we were told it could be a week. You know, obviously we were just a tiny part in this global disaster, you know, and 9,000 people in Nepal had died, you know, so actually we were quite safe and happy up there. We didn't realize that, base camp was like a bomb blast, you know, and the priority was helping the injured people down there. 22 people had sadly died, you know, we didn't really know or understand, but when we got on the radio, you know, Henry just said, it's chaos, everything's gone. We're all like, how's it gone? It's base camp, how's it gone?
Yeah.
And you just can't comprehend that level of destruction. But we just got told to sit tight. You know, we've got food for a couple of days, so we just had to ration everything. Every half an hour, you got aftershocks and avalanches hitting us from both sides. All we can do is sit there and wait.
Wow. And to do that at such a young age as well. And I suppose that leads on really to some of the other things that we're going to talk about, I hope, in terms of the charity, and your sort of ethos and mindset now. I suppose a lot of that has probably been built upon on that, I guess, I would think, in the same way that, you know, our childhood experiences sort of have an effect later on in life. So unfortunately, you didn't summit Everest on both those occasions, not your fault. Is this still unfinished business for you?
I guess I'd say to everybody, they'll have to get my books and find out. And I'm joking. I mean, for a long time I said, you know, maybe one day, not yet. I'm too young to say never. Clearly there was a drive to get me there in the first place. Mm-hmm. But life changes, goals change, values change, and the vision to get me there kind of, you know, faded away. You know, the call just wasn't there. Not so much fear. You know, it's not like I'm afraid of what happened. What happened was a fluke. Yeah. Life, we're all on borrowed time. You know, if we'd been at base camp, I wouldn't be here. Most likely. So you think about the whole perception of risk is it's going to get us eventually. So it's not a case of worrying about what can happen again. As much as my mum thinks that way, it's just a case of the purpose and the reason behind it isn't there anymore. But interestingly, in the last couple of years, in the last year alone, I've really started to reflect on that. And I'm thinking about when and if I go back. I think it is when. But you've got to want it 100%.
Yeah.
And back then I still lived at home. I didn't have the commitments and now I'm self-employed, so I can't be away for 2 months as easily. And the opportunity isn't, I'd have to go back for the right reasons. So Everest has changed a lot in recent years, which is really sad to see. And I want to make sure that magic is still there. I can still feel it.
Yeah.
But I'd go back for me this time. I'm not trying to prove anything anymore.
Yeah. That's good. Well, there we go. So that's keep still tuned. On the card. So yeah, keep staying tuned. You never know. Watch this space. So when you came back from Everest then, still young, 18 years old, what was your plan then? Because you've come a long way in less than 10 years from that point onwards. So bring us up to date with what's happened, because you have made the outdoors your life. And how has that happened?
I think the outdoors chose me, I think. The initial response, you know, I guess at 19, is you can't really deal with anything like this. You're not trained. School doesn't teach you this stuff, right? But initially, there was this massive kind of loss of identity, loss of purpose. There was a big depression again because I'd like lost this focus. I'd had this guilt, you know, of like, why them? Why not me? And after a bit of kind of probably post-traumatic stress, I didn't really deal with it at the time. I just had to find the opportunity. Like, how do I turn this into something positive? You know, as the Sherpas are the most resilient people because they always look for the opportunity. They always make the best of what they have.
Yeah.
So quite quickly it was right. I have an obligation to tell the story. I have an obligation to do something for the Sherpas. So started to write my first book, Icefall, which kind of talks about both his trips and the journey to get there. Which was endorsed by Bear Grylls, which I was chuffed a bit about.
Yeah, we saw that.
Like, properly fangirling. And then doing more challenges. You know, it's like, okay, if not Everest, what can I do close to home? One of the first things I did was actually Everest Thing, which is basically cycling the height of Everest on a bike in 24 hours. So I thought, well, sod this. If I can't climb it, I'm going to cycle it. Again, raising money for the people in Nepal. Unknowingly, that kind of catapulted me into a speaking career because suddenly you've got quite a unique story. I'd already started to do a little bit before this, but actually now the opportunity and demand kind of is probably even more so. Because let's face it, there's lots of people who climbed Everest who are speaking about it. And their experiences are still very valid, but how do you talk to people about what happens when things don't go to plan?
Yeah.
Which is now what I focus on, resilience and overcoming failure. So you think Everest is like the be-all and end-all. But actually, it was just the beginning. Mm. And I guess what happened then was about finding a new purpose in life. And that was more about helping other people.
Yeah.
You know, more about how do I use this experience to help other people to deal with their challenges in life and through speaking, through writing, and now doing more challenges. On the adventure side, initially, it's always hindsight, isn't it? I went to Tibet to try and climb Chowayu, which is the sixth highest peak in the world.
Yeah.
That was done with the intention of going back to Everest the following year, you know, getting an 8,000 meter under my belt, just to almost put that bad experience to bed. But on Cho is really when I had that light bulb moment, when I had that, you know, had it been in my tent on Everest the year before, the tent at base camp, which is, you know, buried under a foot of ice and rock and torn apart, it was like, what would I have left behind? So kind of having a midlife crisis at 21 years old, you know.
Wow, yeah.
It's kind of like, what am I really here for? You know, and that was when I shifted to like UK-based stuff. It's like, well, how can I find some stuff close to home that has the same impact and makes a bigger difference?
Mm.
And I guess running has always been my thing. It's the only sport I'm built for. I'm not good at anything else. So I was like, how can I combine that like UK-based endurance with, you know, with obviously charity and endurance. I'm always keen to do something different, like what hasn't been done before. You know, trying to break records, trying to do stuff that's big enough that's going to raise a lot of money. So I came up with Climb the UK, which was a kind of a human powered 5,000 mile cycle, walk, run, kayak around the UK to the highest point of all 100 counties in the fastest time. And that became my new Everest because that was a challenge where actually it depended not on avalanches or weather or Sherpa strikes, but just my ability to keep on going and to deal with that. That brought so many things. But the main opportunity from that was then the charity. So Mine of the Mountains was inspired off the back of that, where I got contacted by a company called Adventure Uncovered, who wanted to do an event around the outdoors and mental health and hill walking, and they wanted like an ambassador to lead it. So having heard about my challenge that year and all the money I'd raised for Young Minds, they wanted to kind of get me involved. So together we built this weekend retreat, and I brought in Chris, who was one of my first mentors and coaches, and you know, we built this like combination of, you know, hill walking, coaching, counseling, mindfulness and inspirational speakers. because we all know that getting outside is good, but it's like, how do you sustain that?
Yeah.
So kind of came up with this concept, and that weekend became the catalyst for starting Mind Over Mountains as a charity. And, you know, we've been a charity for nearly 3 years. You know, we now have 8 trustees, free paid staff, you know, over 50 freelance staff working for us. We worked with over 300 people last year, you know, and the charity is kind of the legacy that I wanted to leave, but never planned to start so soon.
Yeah.
But for me, the outdoors and nature is my kind of natural health service. That's what keeps me in a good place. And it feels like that is the next step. You know, it's sort of channeling all my challenges and fundraising into that. So yeah, to be honest, now I spend a lot of time speaking about adventures and not as much time doing them, but as we all do, you know, and I think that's where I'm at the moment, is finding the next thing. But ultra running is definitely my passion at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Just going back to your 100 peaks in all the counties, then that to me sounds like a bigger challenge than Everest.
In many ways it was, and it was probably harder than Everest. Not that I've climbed it to say, but, you know, on Everest, you spend so much time sat in a tent eating biscuits and playing cards. Whereas on climbing the UK, it was like every day on my own, not always on my own, but a lot of it was independent.
Yeah.
You know, getting on the bike, doing 100 miles, walking in the rain, getting off the bike, walking up a hill, getting back on the bike, you know, finishing late, starting early. You're waking up in your tent, you see the forecast, it's forecast torrential rain all day, but you've got no choice but to get on the bike and do 100 miles anyway.
Yeah.
Whereas in Everest, there's a lot of downtime. Now, obviously, I can't compare what it would have been like above 8,000 meters in the death zone. But there's that race against time was just relentless.
Yeah.
And it was my own time. I'd set the schedule, but I wanted to finish on that. You know, and you got the same injuries and setbacks. I mean, I had a chest infection. I tore a muscle in my quad. I lost a lot of weight. You got the weather, you know, England has everything. But the best thing about it was the ability for other people to come and be part of it.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the real joy of doing UK-based stuff. Because otherwise, you're on the mountain halfway around the world that nobody even has even heard of, you know.
That's it, yeah.
And that's now where I've been like, okay, how can I push the boundaries, but, you know, close to home?
Yeah. So how much did you raise on that particular challenge?
I think it was about 25K.
Wow.
I should have raised more, really. And now the challenge is, I kind of feel like I should have raised more considering the things I've done. I'm not very good at the whole social media content side of things, which I think now is really important. But yeah, I mean, it got me a Pride of Britain award, which is probably the thing I'm most proud of. And now the challenge is finding something that's equally daft that compels people to support and donate again.
Yeah. So is there plans afoot with that? Have you got the next big challenge?
It's still in the last couple of years, it's just been more kind of like short one day wonders, really. So the last thing I did was the Lake Smears Waters, which is a 105-mile run around the lakes, April 2022. Before that was the Bob Graham Round. The last silly thing was actually 2020 when I ran the National Three Peaks. So most sensible people would drive between them, and that's hard enough. But decided to try and run the whole thing, which is sort of 17 marathons in 9.5 days. That was the hardest physical, mental thing I've ever even attempted. And I finished. I didn't break the record. I missed it by an hour. I think that raised about 11,000. But having done that, I've now pushed the bar even higher, and it's kind of harder to live up to that.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, what's next? The biggest challenge is one I hadn't planned for, which has been actually long COVID. So for the last year, I've been kind of battling through that for a long time, not able to run or train in my usual way, which suddenly you take that toolkit away. You can't just put everything in the box anymore. You've got to deal with it. So in that, I started open water swimming.
Okay.
That was the only thing I could really do without causing a big crash of symptoms. And it's interesting because I've always hated the cold, and I've always hated like deep open water. Yeah. It freaks you out. You can't see down below you. But being in the Lake District, I'm fortunate to have that on my doorstep. And like anything, you've got to find the opportunity.
Yeah.
So the opportunity was, right, I found swimming. So my comeback project this year is the Frog Graham Round, which is basically a swim run challenge combining about 40 miles of running, about 15,000 feet of ascent, and then you swim 2 miles across 4 lakes carry my whole kit for the duration. So there's no time limit, but only about 150 people have done it so far. So right, it's okay. Still quite a niche challenge. And it's interesting because I think I'm going to struggle to raise money with this because people know that sort of thing is just a day out for me normally. But having a few months ago, I literally had to just, I started running again, doing 5x30-second jogs. It wasn't even that. It was 4x30-second jogs, like couch to 5K from the start. To go from, you know, running 60, 70 miles a week and running like sub 3 marathons to literally being beaten by my dad at park run. And, you know, running for 30 seconds because that's all my body could really manage. You know, the challenge is finding something that meets you where you are.
Yeah.
And the Frog Graham, combining the running and the swimming, feels like the best way to do that. And
and
hopefully help anybody else in the same journey. You know, there's 2 million people who are affected by this, apparently in the UK at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's hard for people to understand unless they're there and they've been there. But it has been, without a doubt, the hardest year of my life.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So in terms of challenges, it's not one I thought that was would have been on the forefront. It's your health. And I suppose reminiscent in a way of when you had your injury back when you were training for Everest. And
it was interesting because I was talking about this. I was speaking at an event for a school last week. And you know, and when I reflected on that, I've been here before.
Yeah.
You know, I've got the toolkit. I've just got to apply the same toolkit again. Mm. And like the last time, it's right. Okay, what can I control? What's the opportunity? And, you know, keep the hope, keep the faith. Speak to or find other people that have been there, that have got through it to kind of focus on them. So I didn't find Bear Grylls again, but I found other people, other athletes that have been there that had found their own way through and just followed their process.
Yeah.
And you might be like finding the kind of needle in the haystack as opposed to everybody else that just says, oh, just rest, just stop running, you know.
Yeah.
That was never an option, you know. And when you've been there before, it's a lot less daunting, I think.
Yeah, I think that that's quite an important message for anybody who's in, though, because you've been there at a young age, and no doubt there will be a lot of young people out there now who are going through a similar thing, or people who are older who have had a knockback, and people like yourself who crave adventure and outdoors and want to be out there. You hit the nail on the head there when people say just, you know, take a rest and sit back. It goes against your nature. You can't do that. But those little tools there of sort of focusing on the opportunities, what can I do? Not dwelling on what you can't do. I think that is a great tool to take away from that. Brilliant. So the Frog Graham round then, when are you doing this?
5th of August is the planned date. But as always with my challenges, when I set the date, that basically means that's going to be the first date, but it's probably going to get pushed back because there's something that'll go wrong. I'm hoping not. You know, I've got about 6 weeks at the moment, 5 weeks to prepare for it. I've ran and swam most of the route now. I ran 28 miles on my birthday a few weeks ago. I have this kind of ritual for a mile per year.
Oh God.
The fitness is, that's good. It may backfire as I go, I'll worry about that later. Maybe I'll switch to kilometers. So I feel in a fairly good place. But that's the thing is, there's been an element of, you know, people say, oh, you know, it looks like you're bouncing back, this kind of magical recovery. And it's not like that at all. People often only see the Instagram highlight reel, and as important as it is, and as much as I try to share the full story, sometimes only people see that. And it's kind of a bit disappointing if people think it's in any way made up, because they don't realise that I might go for a long run, but 2 days later I'm literally struggling to get up the stairs, you know, and I'm covered in joint pain and chest pain and headaches and everything. But on the whole, the box is getting bigger, and I feel like I'm ready to do that now. And it's kind of my style, you know. I don't do things the conventional, the sensible way, because that's not what keeps me alive, you know.
Yeah, it's not what pushes the buttons, is it?
And people only know what they know, and almost when you've lived an outdoor lifestyle, you've kind of, once you know it, you can't live without that, you know. And only people that live that way will understand, you know. It's, there is nothing quite like it. But the wild swimming was an alternative to running, and that is now in the toolkit. So inevitably, when I get injured again or something else happens, at least I've got something else to turn to.
Yeah.
And if you learn anything from the pandemic, you know, we can't have all our eggs in one basket anymore.
That's true. Yeah. That's definitely a takeaway. Let me go back to the charity then, Mind Over Mountains. So you set the charity up, and it's very successful as it stands. What is it that the charity does for people? What is it that you're actually trying to achieve?
Essentially, we believe that spending time outdoors is the most powerful intervention for our physical and mental health, and that everybody should have access to that. So what we do is we mostly provide day walks and weekend retreats, which combine hill walking with coaching, counselling, mindfulness and inspirational speakers, giving people a safe space to walk and talk with professional mental health support in amazing places.
Yeah.
You know, and we work with anybody over 18, a wide range of people from all walks of life and different challenges with or without a mental health condition, because we all have mental health. Sometimes we all need that time out, that break. And what's different about it is that combination of, you know, not only being outside, but having that professional support to walk and talk with a counsellor or a coach when you're dealing with a massive life change or trauma is really, really powerful, because there's something about being outside that makes it easy to talk. You know, you remove all that eye contact and that kind of nervous and that, all the kind of facial expressions, especially for men, you know.
Yeah.
And that we've seen it work time and time again. And we now work all over the UK with, said, all walks of life, but we've been doing events a lot with the ambulance service and the blue light services as well.
Yeah.
You know, people that have dealt with a lot of trauma, especially in the pandemic.
Yeah.
This weekend coming, we're doing a retreat for the police. We're doing something in the lakes this weekend as well. So mixing with the general public and, you know, the kind of public sector. So that's what we do. And yeah, we've had a busy few years. I mean, we went from one event in 2019 to then the pandemic came along and we had to cancel everything.
Yeah.
So we scratched our heads together. It's like, okay, well, what can we do? We can't just sit here and do nothing when there's people are isolated and suffering, you know?
Yeah, and probably at the worst time. Yeah.
And yeah. As a charity, I mean, we went to 27 events last year, working with over 300 people. And this year is looking, you know, bigger and busier once again. So the irony of that is, I often say it's like the full-time unpaid job, you know, and it becomes your baby and you kind of, you need to nurture that. And in the pandemic, things got so busy that ironically, I kind of burnt myself out a bit as well. So it's important to focus on our strengths, you know, and as a leader to be willing to put your hand up and say, okay, this isn't sustainable. So I'm really grateful we now have built a team. As Ian has said, he joined as our CEO back in February, shares that vision, got the energy to really take this far and wide. And essentially our vision is to create that kind of natural health service for people.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to see where it is in 5 years time, even 2 years time.
Yeah.
The team right now just live and breathe it. And it's kind of handing it over and supporting them, hopefully by doing daft challenges again. That's where I can make my biggest impact is doing silly things and getting the message out there. You know?
Yeah. Fantastic. I mean, it sounds absolutely amazing. And like you say, when you think about the pandemic, that's not 2 years off of its lifespan, and it's already doing as well as it is.
If anything, it's exciting. If anything, it gave us an opportunity.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of charities suffered in the pandemic. We just went massive. But it's just sustaining that. You know, that's the important thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you've already mentioned one of your books, Icefall. Let's talk about the next one then. So how did it get on then, Icefall? So you've obviously been you've been mentioned by Bear Grylls, which is brilliant. Did that inspire you to then write the next book, or did you just enjoy writing? Was that your thing?
I've always enjoyed writing with the stammer, you know, and it's ironic for a speaker, but I've always been able to express myself much better in words because having the stammer always held me back. And still does to an extent. I always prefer writing. So the plan was always to write a book after Everest, but this ended up being a book, not the one I wanted to or planned to write. Yeah. And in some ways, I remember getting an email off my publisher whilst I was still in Nepal. I think it was a Twitter message just saying like, this is going to be an even better story. Wow, we need to capture this, you know. And then we changed the name of the book before I even got home. And straight away, my publisher were like really on it, really supportive.
Yeah.
Because I thought that was gone as well, like everything, you know, when Everest went pear-shaped twice. First time round was really therapeutic. Actually writing that, getting it all down on paper was a really cathartic process.
Yeah.
And again, I had the luxury of, you know, being at home and being able to spend 5 months just writing the book,
yeah,
which was really healing, quite kind of part of the recovery as well. An Icefall Today is still my favourite book. And, you know, it tells the story from, you know, childhood, this massive dream, to actually, okay, what happens when things don't go to plan. I'd always keep kind of wanted to keep writing more and more books. And then after Climb the UK, there was then a second book, which is How Did You Pick Yourself Up After Everest? You know, how did you rediscover your purpose in life?
Yeah.
And then it was telling the journey of the Climb the UK thing. You know, the people, the places, the journey, the lessons. More of a mental health book. You know, how does the outdoors and mental health kind of work together? So Another Peak came out in 2019. That was endorsed by Mark Beaumont, who's another big hero of mine. There's two. I mean, whenever I do another big thing, there'll be a third. Now the thing is, in the space of 3 or 4 years, is just with the charity and with the speaking now, I don't know when I'm going to find the time to write.
Yeah, you're a busy guy.
Well, everyone's busy, but it's just being busy with the right things, you know, where can you make the biggest impact? But yeah, that's the story of those two. And I did enjoy writing them, definitely the first one. The second one was quite hard because of the mental health side of it.
Yeah.
But I think as well, the first one, it's like that kind of first album. It's always going to be exciting and shiny, you know. So yeah.
Something to be very proud of at such a young age. But again, the life that you've lived thus far, you know, it needs writing down. It needs sharing because it clearly has parts to it that can help other people. I think it's important to write those things down and share them and for people to sort of say, you know, that's an amazing book. Some of the reviews that I've read, particularly on your first book, amazing. Some really, really good reviews.
Thank you.
In fact, Claire was saying she's going to be getting it on her way home.
Well, so. Then, again, off my site. In fact, I've got some upstairs if you need one. It's cheaper than Amazon.
Let's talk about speaking then, because you said that sort of come about from your experiences on Everest and that those stories that haven't been told and shared. And that's just grown, hasn't it? And, you know, we're not just talking about local community centre here now. We're talking big talks, TED talks. How did it grow to that?
Just organically, really. I mean, it was never really planned. Having a stammer, you know, speaking on stage is kind of your worst nightmare. But
yeah.
I find that I'm much better in front of a big crowd of people than I am in a, you know, on a phone or a one-to-one conversation. Put me in a bar full of strangers and I'd rather run a mile and put the full fork in my eye. Honestly, that's the thing, is people think confidence is universal, but I'm much more confident on a stage in front of hundreds of people than you know, one-to-one situations. So it kind of just happened. I mean, obviously you get more experience, you get more demand, then you get referred, then you get bigger stages and bigger gigs. And I remember speaking at Chester Business Club when I was just before Everest, just the first time. And again, that only happened because I'd emailed them trying to get some sponsorship for the trip. And they said, well, actually, our speakers just pulled out of our next dinner. Now, this is like a really reputable club. They have like prime ministers and like Ram Fine speaking in that.
Yeah.
Like an 18-year-old turned up in a suit, not having a clue what he was doing. But I realised I could do it. I got a kick out, you know, I got that real buzz out of doing it. And that particular talk, I remember getting a standing ovation, you know, which is just like phenomenal. So the passion was there. After Everest 2015, it took me, I very nearly binned the whole thing off because there was just so much trauma, you know, trying to relive all that was just too raw at the time. And I just kept getting on stage and getting complete blocks. Like I couldn't speak, the stammer was absolutely worse. And I very nearly just gave up. I was so fed up of turning up on stage and just blocking and blocking and blocking and not being able to control my speech. But giving up doesn't really sit well with me. And luckily I found my place again. I got back on it. And then I think what shifted was like speaking at an awards event, sort of 2013. I remember getting paid like for that, for my first talk. And it's like, oh, this is cool. You know, you get, it's like, you can't even comprehend it. Why would somebody pay me to speak? But I remember like getting that check in the post and like running around the house, like thinking I'd won the jackpot because I'm used to working in the kitchen on like £5 an hour, you know?
Yeah.
And to actually make a living out of inspiring, well, hopefully inspiring people was just like the perfect combination.
Yeah.
And then naturally that's just grown and grown and grown and grown. You know, I've had to keep doing stuff. I've had to hopefully get better and improve and practice and invest in coaching and, every talk, learning, getting better, honing the craft. And naturally, as you do that, you get bigger opportunities. You know, you kind of, you grow to the level of your experience. And nowadays, you know, for the last few years, it's kind of my full-time work. That doesn't mean I'm speaking every day of the week, but, you know, you get a few events a month and mostly in corporate, but still doing a lot of schools, because I think whilst I'm still fairly young, that seemed really important to do.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And also kids relate to you better when you're kind of their age and you look and sound like them.
To go in with like baggy jeans on and a cap backwards and try and look cool.
No, I don't.
I don't think kids do that anymore anyway.
I don't. You've got to feel authentic. But, you know, I like speaking in a suit and tie, but often it's not really me. And to be able to share experiences and kind of both audiences is great. And, you know, I've continued to spend time growing that and developing that and trying to keep doing it. It's given me some amazing opportunities. I mean, recently I was speaking in Switzerland for a school and, you know, I've spoken to some big corporates around the world, and every time pinching myself, literally. And it's the best job in the world. You know, it really is. It comes with the imposter syndrome, the doubt that we all have, and the joys of being freelance, especially in the pandemic.
But
I'm unemployable now, so I've got to make it work. And I hope I'm doing it for many years to come.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Because it's, you know, speaking on resilience and mental health and overcoming challenges are relevant to everybody can relate to that in some way.
Yeah. No matter how small that challenge is or how small that the adversity may seem, it's their Everest, isn't it? I mean, it's the metaphor, isn't it?
I use that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's important. Last of all, we've got one really important question, which I tend to ask a lot of my guests. What is your favourite snack out on the hills?
I'm going to need a podcast just for this. Blimey. Well, so I'm more of a hill runner now than a walker. I'm in the lakes. Normally, I'm out running and doing stuff and jumping in tarns and waterfalls and everywhere. So I'm often on the go, which obviously dictates what I can eat. One of my favourites, and I'm not sponsored by them, is probably Sori Malt Loaf.
I mean,
it's the most universal, both for running and hill walking, you know, super high energy, no mess, doesn't go off, you squidge it into anywhere. Some of that with peanut butter on in a pack is just the perfect hill or running food for all for us.
Yeah.
Sorine is, you can't go wrong, you know, but I think every hill day, every adventure starts with porridge, even in summer. That's my kind of staple.
That's good.
Not on the hill. But yeah, I say Sorine is definitely a regular go-to, and I'll stop there before I start listing off other things. But I tend to go kind of minimal faff. I'm not one of these that sits down on the hill with a salad or a fancy sandwich. I'm just kind of on the go. Sorine, and if I had to say anything else, probably like Scottish fudge chaplet. When I was cycling around the UK, that fudge chaplet got me around the place because it's super high energy, super high carbs. The list would go on.
We're going to add these to our list because it's when we ask people, we just, you know, keep a note of that and we'll take them all out and just try them.
What's the weirdest you've had?
Mackerel rolls.
I love mackerel. I love fish, but not on a hill. Please, why?
You heard that there, Robin.
Sorry. Well, you know, don't knock anything till you've tried it. But I love mackerel and fish.
Yeah.
But the weirdest thing I've seen was on Ben Nevis. I was climbing the Colmore Derry Garrett with a guide a few years ago, and his lunch was just a block of cheese, cheddar cheese. It's at the end of the day, your body just needs calories. And it's just block of cheese. So.
And it's easy to take with you.
Absolutely.
Unless it's a sweaty cheese. You don't want that, do you? Right. Lastly then, how can people follow you and what you do and Mind Over Mountains as well? What's the best place to sort of keep in touch with what you're doing?
I'd love to hear from people. I think firstly, most importantly for the charity, if anybody wants to find out more, if anybody wants to, you know, perhaps, you know, attend our events, if you know somebody that maybe needs that support, you know, we have bursaries available as well, which is really important to say. So if anybody's in financial hardship, they can attend.
Yeah.
Visit our website, mindovermountains.org.uk. And for me personally, I mean, if you want to follow the next disasters, adventures, I'm on all the normal places on social media. So Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Strava. I share quite a lot on there. And just to say, really, I mean, my mentors and coaches have always given me their time for nothing, but on the condition that I pay it forward. So if anybody has another big goal that I can help with, then please, I'd love to hear from them. Please do feel free to contact me if you've enjoyed the episode.
And fantastic.
So yeah, on social media, on my website, alexsamuelfield.com, and my books are available on there as well if you want signed copies.
Excellent. Yeah. And I'll share those in the show notes as always. But thank you very much for your time. And it's been absolutely fantastic chatting to you.
No, it's been fun, and thank you for having me.
Thank you.
What an awesome guy, a real inspiration to young people and adults alike. I can tell you that Alex completed the Frog Graham round in 16 hours, 57 minutes and 45 seconds. And if you'd like to make a donation, you can see the links to Alex's socials in the show notes. Now, with the launch of Series 5, we've given the official supporters platform a makeover. With just one flat rate tier of £5 per month, you can support the podcast over on Patreon. As a supporter, you'll get fortnightly bonus episodes, Something Else Brew with a View, where Claire and I chat about this, that, and everything in between, whilst out on a walk in the great outdoors. It's completely uncensored, unedited, and 100% us being us, so it's guaranteed to be a laugh at our expense, as well as us opening up about the real people behind the microphones. As a supporter, you'll also get access to behind-the-scenes content on Patreon, Summits to Talk About, and exclusive Something Else stickers. Every penny that comes in goes straight back into producing the podcast, so we'll see you over there. That is all for this episode. Keep putting one foot in front of the other, and we'll see you in the next one.